The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening. I just came back yesterday from teaching a two-week retreat, and so I don't know what to say. I thought I had nothing to say because I gave a lot of talks at the retreat every night, every afternoon. We were almost 2 weeks, so that how much more can a person say? But I think it's more not so much that I talk so much, but there's something about being on retreat for me sometimes where there's a kind of a feeling of quiet or contentment or fullness where it seems kind of odd to speak. So I have a little bit of that today. But I will... one of the things that stood out to me at the retreat is how meaningful it is for some people to become simple. That human beings have an amazing capacity for making things more complicated than they need to be. And much of our lives are often lived in our head and our thoughts. And on retreat, there's a slow process that sometimes is actually quite a bit of work of taming the mind so the mind is not spinning so much into its world of thoughts and imaginations. And finally, when the mind quiets down enough so it's not, the mind's not thinking about other times and other places, some people report that things seem very simple, but at the same time very full, or at the same time very meaningful. I mean, it's quite remarkable on retreat to have people come to an interview sometimes to meet with me, and what they want to talk about is the sparkle of the dew on the leaf. It's like, wow, look at that, the way that the light was, and it's because there's something in contrast to the mind that's caught up in a lot of thoughts and concerns and worries and fears, to have all that go away and have like the curtains pulled from the eyes and see with clarity the world, it can be it's a beautiful thing to see the world. So we live often not in that world of clarity and simplicity, but in the world of complexity. I told a story, a couple of stories from the retreat I'll share with you. One is that there's a Mahayana Buddhist scripture that's quite elaborate. It's quite a big scripture, but a big part of it is a description of a journey, of a spiritual journey of some person, mythic person. And then part of his mythic journey, this man named Sudana goes up to some heavenly realm where this great god, he's heavenly realm, and there he meets this kind of celestial being. And the celestial being is going to show him his palace, the celestial palace. And the text then describes in vivid detail the palace. This is written for a time and place where they didn't have TV. Or movies. So, a storyteller had to kind of spin a tale that would create images for people, and people would enter into the images that were created. And so the storyteller here in the scriptures paints a very, probably for the time, very compelling picture with a lot of detail of this massive, beautiful palace with jewels and gold and silver and marble, and the scale of it is phenomenal. And so this Buddhist pilgrim standing there in the middle of this big palace looking at it in wonder, as it's being all pointed out to him by the celestial being. And so imagine the audience who's listening to it or reading the text is pulled into this world as well. And then the text, suddenly, without any preparation, the celestial being who's doing the tour snaps his finger, and the palace vanishes. And the pilgrim looks around, what happened? And it's partly meant to be a teaching on emptiness, how everything's empty. But I think more important, it's a description of how quickly we can snap out of our fantasies and our delusions and illusions. We live in one world, and then we see actually it's not that world at all. So at the retreat also, I told a story of when I was in... So I lived for about 3 years in a Zen monastery at Tassajara, down here in the Los Padres National Wilderness, off the big coast, Big Sur coast. And the way that the monastery supports itself and the way it's kind of set up is that during the summer months, it's kind of a resort. Then guests come and pay a lot of money. And then in the winter, from September to through April, it's when it's a Zen monastery and it's closed to the public and we do a lot of intensive practice. So I spent a year assigned in the monastery kitchen. I didn't know almost anything about cooking when I started. And by the time I finished, I had learned a lot about cooking and thought of myself as a fairly good cook and had been promoted in the ranks of the kitchen. And had become kind of the kitchen manager kind of position. And kind of working with me, under me, aside me, above me or something, was a group of people called, three people called the guest cooks. And the guest cooks were the cooks who cooked for the summer guests. And the summer guests got really good food. And it was like, maybe, you know, kind of gourmet food, wonderful vegetarian food. So I had become such a good cook and so competent in the kitchen, and I looked around the monastery, and I knew everybody, and I knew that I happened to be the most competent cook left standing. And so my year in the kitchen ended in September, and so then we went into the winter months of being intensive monastery, and we spent a lot of time meditating and a lot of time in the meditation hall. Especially with three meals of the day, we would have in the meditation hall, in meditation posture, sitting like I am with a little space in front of us, like here on this platform, and we'd have bowls and the whole choreographed way in which they'd come and serve you, and you'd chant and you'd eat, and you'd eat in this very meditative way. Well, starting in September, after I left the kitchen, I was convinced that I was going to be assigned to be the guest cook the next summer. Because I was the only person, you know, most qualified person. So I spent a lot of time that fall and winter planning menus and recipes. And all these meditative meals that we had, I was evaluating the food and thinking about what I was going to do, how I would do it different, and how I would mix the different combination of food and all this stuff, right? We're sitting, eating like meditation posture, right? And so you're supposed to be meditating and being very present, but I was, you know, present and imagining and fantasizing and thinking about this wonderful job I was going to be so wonderful at. So that went merrily along for the fall and the winter. And then come the end of April, it's time in this wonderful Zen way, the ritual announcement of everybody's jobs for the summer. And we all go standing in the zendo in the meditation hall, and we're all standing at attention, and someone's reading out the names and your assignment, because you never know where you get assigned the monastery. You get assigned someplace to do a job that you know nothing about. And so they came to my name, and lo and behold, they did not read my name. Oh, they did not put me in the kitchen. I did not become a guest cook. And I was like flabbergasted. I mean, how? What? But as soon as I got over my surprise, the next thing that flashed in front of me was all those months where I sat in meditation with the meals, you know, kind of supposed to be meditating while I'm eating. And all those months, all those hours where I was fantasizing and thinking about how great I was going to be or how great the food was going to be and my menus and all that. And I thought, wow, I spent a lot of time doing that. I could have been doing something different. I could have been meditating. So I was rather embarrassed. It was kind of like, kind of a little bit of a shock. It's like, wow, I really wasted my time in a certain way. I could have, you know, it was a monastery. I was very serious about being a practitioner, I thought, and so I could have been practicing. So, but just, you know, as soon as that, my name was announced with my job for the summer, it was kind of like someone snapped their fingers, and I woke up from the dream that I've been dreaming for all those months. And this idea, so we know this idea of waking up from the dream. And sometimes we're lucky and it's sudden, and sometimes it's a slow process. And meditation is one of the ways that sometimes it's fast, but more often is a slow process. Because one of the things we're doing in meditation is we're learning to not give in to the strong currents of thinking that goes on in the mind. Not to indulge in it, not to be hooked by it. And the forces of the mind, that of interest, that are driven by desire, driven by fear, driven by hostility, driven by all kinds of things, driven by issues of self-identity. One of the interesting things about the thinking we do is, for most people, most of the obsessive thinking that we do, generally it's centered about ourselves. We're like a main character in the play. And so that's very interesting if you're at the center stage or close to the center stage or it somehow has to do with you. So to discover the power and the strength of the interest of the hooks that keeps us engaged, and then learn to slowly relax the mind, relax those tentacles that hold on to our thoughts, and to be able to relax and relax and relax until finally we can wake up and we see the world, see the situation, not through the lens of the thoughts and the beliefs and the ideas that we're caught in, but rather we see it directly, ideally without any lens at all, just to see something clearly. And in that process, some people wake up to how much time they spent in delusion, how much time they spent lost in thought. And it's very hard to think to see how the ways that we think color our experience of life dramatically. And we don't see it that way. We think it's real because that's all we know. So we see our other people in our lives, we see our jobs, we see the work, we see what needs to happen in the world, we see the world itself very powerfully through the filter of certain beliefs, certain emotional feelings, attitudes towards what the world is, who we are, who other people are. And because it's, you know, the kind of what we've always been familiar with as much as we can remember, it's sometimes invisible to us how much of a filter we have. And so to sit down and meditate is one of the ways, I think very powerful ways, to begin not only to kind of clear the veils so we can see directly, but I think more importantly, maybe more importantly, or as important, is to learn the skill, learn the capacity of mind to be able to see more clearly what we're doing when we caught in our thoughts and how to put our thoughts down, how to be free of them. It's what, you know, if all you want to do is to clear your mind, you can do, there are things you can do to clear your mind. And you'll suddenly, wow, you know, that's something. But you won't learn anything in the process. You won't learn how to tame your mind, how to take responsibility for your own mind in the process. My favorite clearing your mind story was many years ago. I saw a little documentary, 10 minutes or so long, and it was about a man who, before he was married and had children, I think he had been like a motorcycle racer. The weekends he would out the motorcycle, and he found that racing his motorcycle around cleared his mind from the work, from working for all week long, and it was great. But after being married and having kids, he didn't have a time to go out in this motorcycle racing rides or something. So he had to find something else to clear his mind. So he discovered that if he, early in the morning, or just before dawn, he and his buddies, they would drive to some place in the city where there was a skyscraper being built. And they would sneak in to the skyscraper and climb up to the top, and then he would jump off the top with a glider, like parachute gliders or something. And he would just glide down to the street below where his friend would be with a car waiting, the getaway car. And then he would take his parachute glider and wrap it all up and get in the car and drive off. It didn't take very long to jump off the building and glide down. By the time he got down to the bottom, his mind was clear. So you could do that, too. But the issue with that is, many people have things they do for that purpose, is does it teach you about how to take responsibility for your own mind, how your mind works, so you can get in there and actually watch and track it and perhaps do the kind of preventive maintenance where you don't even get caught in the first place. And that's really, I think, what we're hoping to do, is to come to a place where we're wise enough about how our mind works that we start living in a way that we don't get ourselves caught in stories and ideas and fantasies, and we see clearly, what's going on, and then we're just there. And it's easy to get caught. I didn't get caught today, but I had one thought today many years ago I probably would have been caught up in, and that was the importance of giving a great talk today. I didn't have anything to talk about. I thought so. I thought, oh, that's not good. I mean, I should have a great talk, and probably had great guest speakers the last few weeks, and I better rise to the standard they set, and I have to give you an exceptional talk and wow everybody. And so that I could see for a brief moment those kinds of thoughts went through my mind. But I just saw them. Wow, look, Gil, you're still doing those kinds of strange thinking, and that's not true. I don't have to believe those. I don't have to spend fall and winter thinking about the talk I'm going to give. And that's not the Dharma. That's not freedom. So I had enough ability to see that and not buy into it, kind of smile at my mind thinking that way. Have some slight apprehension that if I didn't come down here with something prepared well, that it wouldn't go well for us tonight. But what's this about anyway? Is it about coming and giving a great talk, or is it about coming and or being concerned that people like me or something, or is it about seeing how that operates in the mind and not being caught by it, being awake to it and say, okay, I don't go there. I don't need to be involved. I'll try to be free of that. So that's my little thing for today. So now it's your turn. Because one of these really great spiritual teachers, Buddhist teachers, who really want to wow everybody about how, right, and that they're talking all that, gives the responsibility to you. So now it's up to you. I'm done. So this is going to be a great evening now. I've done my share. Now it's your turn. So do you have any questions or comments you'd like to make or anything at all? You're welcome to ask. Yes, please. Actually, wait and use the mic, please. And it's nice if you say your name also when you begin.
My name is Noel, and I decided about a week ago that I was going to give a party because, I have this first grandchild and I have friends that want to meet the baby. And so, my son and daughter-in-law, I thought it was a great idea, but I never give parties. And I'm just like, that's all I can think about, after I've gone through this really pleasant experience of being at IMC and really getting with this program and thinking I'm, you know, on my way. You know, this is just like supposed to be fun, and it's not at all. And I'm just, you know, and I know that what you're going to say, what are you worried about? You know, why is that important? Why is that important to you? What if you just did this? And still, it's just like, I don't know. I just don't know how to, you know, stop, you know, lassoing, you know, the cold and, you know, just and get it. I just am very agitated with this whole process. And so I'm asking you, like, how do you cool it off? How do you cool it off?
Great question. Great. I appreciate that a lot. Thank you. And so one of the jobs of a meditation teacher like me is partly to be a cheerleader. So I want to be your cheerleader. I'd like to comment that the fact that you see it so clearly, what you do, you described it very clearly, counts for a lot. You have enough presence, enough mindfulness, enough wisdom to see how this operates and see that that there must be another way and you don't want to do that. And it can be uncomfortable, and some people can feel kind of bad about themselves to see all that. I'm a bad Buddhist now, or I'm not doing it right. But actually, what you describe, how you saw that, and how you're taking responsibility for it, I want to be your cheerleader. That was really great. So, but still, it's hot, right? Still, it's, you know, still not comfortable. But I think so. Then some people find it very meaningful to know once they realize what you understood is it can be very helpful to see if you have any confidence in the path you're on. The practice you've discovered here at IMC, the mindfulness path, is a very powerful path. And it might not be so effective, completely effective as you want this time, but the fact to know that you have a path, a technique that works, that can lead you over time to be free of this kind of stuff, that can also help you relax. Sometimes cool you down because of the confidence you have. Yes, I have something that can really help here, if you know that. The other is it really helps also to have a lot of forgiveness, acceptance, compassion for yourself. Some people, what they do is they add the second arrows. You know about the second arrows? So it's bad enough that you have this, you know, all these thoughts about the party, but then on top of that, you add the second arrows. You add, I'm a bad person. I'm a failure. I'm the world's worst party giver, you know. I hope no one ever asks me about how I am as a party giver because I've failed, you know. And so we build up all this stuff on top of it, and so it really helps to have a lot of to a certain degree of acceptance, of compassion, forgiveness, and if you can, some humor about it. And that doesn't help the original thing, but it kind of makes things lighter. Because one of the things that makes our challenges like this more difficult than they need to be is we take it and ourselves often too seriously. And so, you know, to learn to kind of lighten up a little bit, it's easier for me to say than to do. And then sometimes it's really good to do something that pulls you out of that world. If you're go for a walk, even to take a shower or to meditate, or go find a friend who can talk about something else with you. Do something to pull you out of it enough so that when you go back into to party planning, you go in with a little bit more being more centered. That can help. And then in some quiet time, maybe in the morning if you meditate, or some quiet time when you're you have more time to reflect on what's going on, you can try to look more deeply at what are the underlying beliefs and maybe emotions that underlie your concern about this party. And there might be, if you're calm enough and present enough for yourself, you might see that there's some kind of catalyst, some kind of hook that's a little bit subconscious that takes a while to see, and then you say, oh, that's what it's about. And something that preoccupied me for a long time was that I didn't know about was wanting people to like me. And I would do all this mental gymnastics, social gymnastics to try to get people to like me. And then that was one of the also great things about living in the monastery. Actually, for a year I was in the kitchen, being the kitchen manager. No one likes, in the Zen monastery, no one likes the kitchen manager. And one of the people who worked on my crew said, "Gil, I need to talk to you outside." So I went outside the kitchen with him, and he said, "Gil, if you weren't so sincere, I'd punch you out." So in that context, this whole endeavor to try to get everyone to like me and be concerned about it didn't work. It was just a lot of work, and I could feel the pain of it. And so there, I eventually saw that's driving my behavior. And once I saw that, then I could start getting free of it. So, Noel, right? That's some of the things that occurs to me to say. Is any of that relevant?
Yeah, because I could tell I want them to like the baby too. So, like, that's a double. Like, I want them to like me and like the baby and like the party.
And with the baby, who knows? You know, like, so we did a baby blessing. My first son, and I have a Zen teacher, Mel Weitzman, in Berkeley. So we went out. We thought we'd go over there. We had a little private ceremony in the little Zen center in the meditation hall, and to do a little chanting and a little baby blessing. And I was holding him, and in the middle of that, he just kind of vomits all over me. So you know, good luck with those babies. Someone else? Yes? Here.
I was at a recent retreat, and it didn't turn out as I had expected. And then shortly thereafter, I read an article that put things in perspective. Anticipation is premeditated disappointment.
Anticipation is premeditated disappointment. I think generally, that's one of the great, I shouldn't say this, I suspect that one of the great ways that meditation retreats work for people, really help them a lot, is they're never what we expect them to be. What do you think, Richard? Retreats are never what we expect them to be? No? They're exactly what they're supposed to be, but not what we expected them to be. What do you think, Laura?
I'm speechless.
You're speechless. She just came back from the retreat. Both of them came from the retreat. So they're like quiet like me, kind of. Anticipation is premeditated disappointment.
The thing that struck me as you were talking is this is the beginning of the school year, and I teach at the university, and these are juniors and seniors, and there's many of them that have a deeply held dream that they're going to medical school. And it just hit me that there's a balance between, in order for them to put up with all that's involved in succeeding in college, they have to have a really strong vision, a strong craving for what they're going for, or they would have stopped a long time ago. And it just struck me as how that's a kind of a delicate line to walk between that and your long winter long what's going to happen. I mean, they're doing that with, oh, when I become a doctor, I'm going to be able to do,
I think the line between delusion and a healthy vision, possibility, and also so what's the fantasy, what's the purpose, what are we trying to build and create? And So, I mean, being a doctor can be a great service to the world. And it can come out of compassion and vision to be helpful. It can also become out of a vision of being, you know, the next Mother Teresa, and, you know, you're going to solve all the world's problems and how great it's going to be, and you'll get to drive a BMW. And so you have all these, you know, this whole fantasy that's created. And so, you know, what's driving it? So that's what, again, also, when we start being mindful of ourselves and have the ability to stop and really get quiet and to see what goes on in the mind and to track it, then we can start seeing the difference between what's pure fantasy, what's delusion, what's a healthy vision, appropriate perspective, and what our relationship to it is. We have a lot at stake. It's possible to devote one's life to a tremendous amount of one's effort, like maybe to go to medical school, but in certain kind of way, not have anything at stake, meaning maybe in a spiritual way, meaning that your sense of self-importance, who you are in the world, doesn't have to be tied to success in the endeavor you're doing. You're already content and happy with who you are. And if you're trying to use something like, I guess your situation, becoming a doctor as a way to somehow make yourself into an acceptable, wonderful, perfect person for, you know, the people who come and look at your baby, or whatever, then it's a fantasy. Then it's, you know, it's probably a setup. You're perpetuating a certain delusion, which will probably come back and bite you over and over again.
Well, what hit me is if people, I mean, a lot of us are have kind of been through the slings and arrows of life for a while, yeah, and might have the wisdom to do that. But how many college students have got that? You know, they're not there yet, most of them, and that's like, ooh, wow, I'm watching some suffering, I guess.
Yeah. Sometimes a lot of unnecessary suffering happens in this world. The thing about suffering, they say that there's a part of the lore, lore of Buddhism, is that no one comes to Buddhism without suffering. So sometimes you have to suffer enough to think, you know, I think I need an alternative than what I have been doing. And so people start looking around for an alternative. And some people will come to a place like IMC because they're struggling in their life in some way. And so they think they find here something that's a path, a way that helps them deal with it. But until they suffer enough. And some people come to like a Buddhist group and they find some relief from their suffering. And some people then, when they find the relief, which is great, then will leave the Buddhist practice because they got what they did. And when I was first being introduced to Buddhism many years ago, I was told by one of my Zen teachers that he saw many people come to Zen Center, and after 3 or 4 years, they had kind of fulfilled what had brought them there. They found a stronger sense of self, they found their place in society, they weren't so stressed anymore, and it was good. And then they had to go continue their life. But he said, as the people who continued after that, they're the ones who really started doing Buddhist practice, a path of liberation that, you know, went further.
To continue your story just now, after you realize that you are doing all this social gymnastics to gain
to like me.
Yeah, to like you, right? After you realize that, how does it change how you approach other people, and how do you deal with like your own tendency about that?
I see. So after I realized that I was driven by this desire to have people like me, did all this social gymnastics. And I realized that, how did that change? What did I do then? I realized it because it hurt. That was really what, it got to be really painful and a drag. And so, it's often a lot of learning happens when things hurt, when there's suffering and we feel the stress of it. And so seeing it didn't make it go away. But what happened when I started seeing it, I became much more sensitive to that form of suffering. And so I saw it quicker and more often. And as I got to see it more often, I got more sensitive to it, and I was able to look at it more, understand it better. And then one of the things that started happening was that I was willing to experiment with not acting on it. I'm willing to take the risk of just kind of being quiet or not trying to impress someone. And then I did the experiment to see how that would work out or see if I survived. And my survival rate was very high. It seemed to work out, you know, well enough for me. So that helped me to relax it and not be so concerned with it. The other thing that helped me a lot was meditation practice, because meditation practice gave me a sense of well-being, a sense of calm or peace, or a feeling content or whole or something, that became an alternative to the feeling of incompleteness that was driving the desire to be liked. Because, you know, I felt something was wrong with me. I was, but being liked, I'd be safer, I'd be fuller, I'd be, you know, something. And so it helped also both to feel the suffering, as I said, helped, but it also helped to really feel an alternative way of being. And as I started feeling a greater sense of well-being and sense of completeness, then the concern, the fear, and the concern for people to like me began to melt away. And it was a slow process. It wasn't like just like that. It probably took many years, actually. Probably, I don't know, 5 years from the time I really saw it to I felt like I'm fairly free of it. But I'm not completely free of it, right? Because I had this thought earlier today about I need to give a great talk. Is that enough? Thank you. So maybe one more. Mary. What's your name?
My name is Harry.
Harry.
When you said that you started to notice that then you didn't have to act on it, and you said meditation had something that helped, but I think that that's what's happening to me, is that meditation, many years really, and it's given me space between what I ordinarily oh, freedom. And I just am so grateful for it. I've only been doing things fast, and I had something to say about everything, and I'm just so grateful.
Great. So meditation gave you space, slowed you down enough that you found where the freedom was.
Yes.
Wow. Hallelujah. It's great to be a cheerleader. That's wonderful, Mary. And yes, I think that's one of the things, slowing down. And what happens, what you'll probably notice is that the delusive thinking, the caught up in fantasies and the future and all these things, the mind tends to be operating pretty fast then, and there's very little space. But as we slow down, there's space even in the mind. And that in that space, we can find the freedom you talked about. So that's beautiful. Thank you. Okay, so thank you for meditating together with all of us today. I loved coming here this evening and just sitting and meditating with you. I hope it was nice for you, and I hope our conversation about this topic was nice and helpful. And have a nice week. Thank you.